we've been talking about repaying kindness and our feelings about when we see other people repaying or not repaying kindness, right? And so how we're often very focused on other people repaying our kindness, yeah, and getting quite fixated on this idea of fairness. I think one of the first things American kids especially learn, you know, especially if you have siblings, your first vocabulary is, it's not fair. He gets to, she gets to, it's not fair. And so we continue this all the way through to becoming an adult. You know, in the mind we whine just as much, although outside we make it look much nicer. But the mechanism is the same. So this whole thing of fairness, you know, I did something for them, they're not repaying my kindness properly, and they should do this and that. So these kinds of thoughts arise very frequently, you know, and along with that is the thought they're taking advantage of me. Yeah. That's another one where really, we have our, what do you call them, the little feelers or sensors, you know, anything that smacks of somebody taking advantage of me, oh boy, you know, I'm going to jump on that one. So it's quite interesting, because again, we don't think of ourselves taking advantage of other people or not repaying their kindness or whatever, but we're very focused on them doing that to us. So when I've looked, you know, taking advantage, somebody taking advantage of me, you know, I've done X, Y, and Z, and they aren't reciprocating. And I see that when I'm thinking like that, my motivation for doing X, Y, and Z was not a motivation of taking delight in giving. There might have been some delight in giving, but somewhere back there, there was another little agenda of, yes, I feel so good about giving, you know, because I like that person, and that's why I feel good about giving. And they probably like me, and, you know, they'll reciprocate because that's what you're supposed to do. Okay? So I see that, you know, even there might have been delight in giving at the beginning, but then I began to add all these strings to it. Or maybe my delight in giving was not so big at the beginning. Because if you really focus on, I feel so happy about giving, then you're not focused on, are they accepting it? Do they appreciate it? Are they reciprocating? Because you're just focused on the giving part of it. Okay, so you see the change in motivation or the stinkiness of the motivation comes in. Now somebody's going to say, well, does that mean that if you're a real practitioner, you just do everything for anybody, everybody, and no matter how they treat you back, you just continue doing it? You know, that we erase from your vocabulary and your conceptual ability people taking advantage of you. Is that what it means? No, it doesn't exactly mean that. But what you start to do is you begin to look at, is another person's action or attitude something that is benefiting them? Okay. So I might be giving and giving and giving, and I don't feel like I'm being taken advantage of. But perhaps the way they are thinking about the situation or the motivations they have for their actions are not virtuous and are not wholesome. And so therefore, if I continue giving in this way, it's not really being fair to the other person, because it creates this kind of, I guess you call it dysfunctional relationship, yeah, you know, or enabling somebody, yeah, something like that. So here, you're looking at the situation not in terms of I did so much, therefore they should, but is their attitude and behavior benefiting them? Okay. Now, sometimes we're not sure exactly what their attitude is, so we need to explore that a little bit and see what they're thinking about. Yeah. But if we see that somebody's having a mind of, well, I don't need to do anything because if I just slack off, somebody else will come pick up the pieces. You know, that it's not benefiting the other person to allow them to go through their life with that attitude, because they're going to have a lot of unhappiness if they go through life thinking, doesn't matter what I do, somebody will fix it at the end. You know, I don't have to be responsible for myself. I don't have to be responsible for everybody else. You know, somebody will rescue me. That's not a good attitude to let somebody continue to live with. And so as a result, out of compassion for them, then you might stop your giving. Okay? But you're not stopping your compassion towards them. Yeah, you're stopping some behavior that you're seeing that although you take delight in it, it's not something that helps them. Yeah? Okay, are you getting what I'm saying here? Yeah? Okay, so it's a difficult one. It's a very difficult one because whenever the thought comes, they're taking advantage of me. Very often there's a mixture of the two things in our mind. There's a mixture of they should reciprocate, and there might be something quite validly coming from their side of their, you know, not having a good attitude. Yeah. So very often situations are this murky kind of mixture of unwholesomeness on everybody's part. Don't you love it, you know, when samsara is unclear like this? Actually, it's very clear. It's unwholesome. It stinks, you know. But when our mind is so stuck in it, it's hard. Those situations are difficult. So we really need to spend some time, you know, and looking at what's going on in my mind and what was my motivation for giving and what am I expecting? What am I wanting back? All these kinds of things, and really work stuff out in our mind, you know, so that our mind is peaceful, so that we're not looking at what we're getting out of it. And then also checking up what's really going on with the other person. And then, if need be, you know, stopping our behavior that looks like generosity but isn't.
Yesterday, as you know, one of my teachers, Geshe Gelson, died. And I've known Geshe Lha for many, many years. I think I met him actually right before I ordained in 1977. I had come back here to the U.S. And this was the time when my parents were freaking out. And so I met Geshe Lha then. And he was always... See, the first thing he taught us was taking and giving meditation. Mm-hmm. And it was like every time I heard teachings, it was taking and giving meditation. So it was that and Vajra Yogini. Those are the two things that really stick out in his mind. And so that's, I'm sure, what he was practicing as he was dying. He had cancer, mm-hmm. and so there was the bloating and the vomiting and it was just all over his body and everything. But he was at the Dharma Center and he passed away there. There were a group of the Chartsey monks there because they had been on tour, so they were doing puja, mm-hmm. which is really nice. And he has a lot of old students. I mean, a lot of the students have known from way back when. And, so... He just passed away quite peacefully. I'm sure he's meditating in the clear light and he's going to go to Vajrayogini's Pure Land. I mean, I have no doubt at all about no fear or concern about Geshe-la in that way. So, but it's very good that we do the King of Prayers and that we make prayers for his quick return. And I think it's also good to make some prayers for the center there. I learned a lot by watching the development of that center, and it's it and watching the development of other centers have very much shaped my feeling about things, which I wanted to share. And I don't know how you people feel about it, you know, but at DFF and also here, I don't feel like this is my center or my monastery. I feel like it's our center and our monastery. You know, I have a certain job in it, but it's not mine. And if I'm not here, it continues on because it's yours. Yeah. Same way with DFF. What I'm noticing in watching TDL is it's always Geshe, it's from the beginning Geshe-la's center. And he, you know, was always trying to get one of my friends to take it over and become, you know, the new director, administrator, teacher. And she was quite resistant to this because the center was, he made all the decisions in it. So, you know, there were a lot of different things going on in terms of helping the monasteries, helping Tibetans who arrive in America and don't have visas and place to stay, helping his family members, helping, you know, all sorts of other things going on, you know, at the center, not just the Dharma program for the people who come to the Dharma program. There are all these other things going on. And so, you know, she has resisted taking it over because of all those other things and not wanting to get involved in all of them. But it's interesting because, you know, like within the last month, they've decided to give the center to the monastery in India. And so the legal entity of the center will remain, but the monastery in India will take over the running of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But of course they're going to depend on the Americans to do a lot of the running of the monastery because they don't know the American way, but they're going to be setting the vision of the monastery. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's just made me think about, you know, and for the American students, it's very acceptable. You know, whereas I have always felt like I don't want something to be seen as mine, where I have the power to give it away to somebody else, you know, but it's ours, and we're all doing this together, and when I'm not here, you guys continue on, you know, and you make whatever changes are needed, or you invite somebody else to come and teach, or, you know, but you run the place. So, I don't know, it's just an interesting thing for me to observe, because very often in the West, especially in Tibetan centers, it is, but also other traditions too, it's the center is looked at as the teacher's center, you know? And the teacher calls the shots for everything, even how you do the administrative work. Whereas I really feel that things should be administered by everybody, and that everybody in some way or another should have some role in the decision making that's going on. Yeah. So in terms of us, what we're doing here, okay, I'm the longest term monastic, so it makes sense that I'm setting the vision. Okay, but when there's other monastics who've been, you know, around just as long, then, you know, then they know how to set the vision. Yeah. But then we all have our own roles here, and we all give feedback, and we all have comments on things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
thoughts about this?
I think this is where the community meetings become so crucial and beneficial. That through the life in those community meetings, we do, and we're getting better at, from what I've seen in my limited experience, at making those community-type decisions together as a community. And I think the more we use those community meetings for that purpose, the stronger the community as a community becomes.
I also feel like the longer that we're, each of us is ordained, the fact that you're sending us out to share what we know about the Dharma, that it puts into people's minds a little bit more of a bigger look on who's actually holding this space. Because of your reputation and your longevity as a monastic and who you are, there's such a zoning in, there's even a propensity for your community to do the same thing. So as we get more mature and grow in our training by us being out in the world representing the Abbey, then it kind of pulls the energy and makes people look at this as a little bit bigger, inclusive, more than one person's place.
Exactly.
Which I've seen a difference in that just in the past year with that other talking with Chimney and I. And hopefully as the Sangha grows, we do that.
Yeah, very much. Very much.
But how would you see the role of the advisory board? I think I always had in my mind that you were gone, you were dead tomorrow, that we would be calling Circle Rinpoche.
Well, I think you would be asking for advice from the different people on the advisory board, but I wouldn't expect any of them to come here and make it their center and take over the running of it. And because we've set in way a certain way of doing things, and if you can invite a Tibetan to come and teach you the Dharma, but if you invite a Tibetan to come and run this place, you will have a totally different structure. And that was one of the things that I felt very strongly about in beginning the Abbey, is it's got to be Western run according to the way we do things here. And so I would want you to function as a community and figure out, okay, do you want to invite another teacher? Who comes and does it? Who's going to be the administrator? How can we all support that person who's the administrator? And certainly, you know, ask for help from the advisory board. But I don't think they're going to come here. And Sirkin Rinpoche's 23, he doesn't know how to run a Western monastery. He can tell you how to be in a Tibetan monastery. But if you do that, first of all, the nuns are going to be out. And no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm glad you did too.
Yeah. It's quiet in here while the nuns were gone.
Very quiet.
But
if you ask a Tibetan monk to come and administer it as a monastery, the first thing he's going to do is say it's got to be one sex, and that means the women leave. Except the women who are benefactors. There will be a guest house for them.
Yeah, this is the model we see all over the place, except for Shasta Abbey.
That's the model, and that's how it's... That's what they're familiar with. That's what they know.
But I'm wondering how it is, like, in Taiwan, when they have, like, someone like who started some of these bigger centers there, like Fo Wan Shin or even Chung Tai. When that master dies, do those centers continue on, or do they? I mean, they're so huge. There's 1,000 monks at that place, or just the whole thing just like can't just. I mean, over time, I suppose it could fizzle out, but it seems like they have so much infrastructure.
I know.
So I'm thinking maybe their model has a little more longevity to it than I don't know, really.
You know, it depends very much on how it happens when the teacher is alive. Mm-hmm. I know in Thailand that when the teacher dies, often the place really diminishes a lot because people were coming for that teacher.
Mm-hmm.
In Taiwan, you know, it's very much looked at as that teacher's center, but because they have so many people and they have to have a huge infrastructure, then I think in some way or another it's got to continue.
Mm-hmm.
How it continues is something else. The model with, you know, City of 10,000 Buddhists, Master Hua's center, what they did is they have, you know, different councils, one the monastic council and then a council with lay people and monastics, and they make all the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting, everybody there has to see themselves as a disciple of Master Hua, even though Master Hua isn't alive.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the monastics there are allowed to take their own disciples, and they would be very, they've told me, they would be very suspicious of each other if they heard of any of them taking their own disciples. I think, first of all, in terms of ordination, you have to take ordination from a living teacher. Yeah, but the way they do it, they say your ordination is coming from Master Hua. That's why I didn't have you go there. Yeah, one of the reasons, you know, go there. But don't say this to them, you know, but it's got to be a living teacher. And then, you know, how many generations can you go on without a living teacher present? You know, because you get so much inspiration from your own connection with a living teacher. Yeah. The way they did at Shasta is they elected a new abbot there, and then, of course, they have another person who's in charge of their whole worldwide order. You know, so they diffused it, and their senior monastics can take their own disciples. What will happen with Chiang Tai and Po Kwan Shan, it will be very interesting to see.
Because Po Kwan Shan, it's in their rules. You don't take disciples.
Right. Know what happens when the monk, you know, will he appoint one person to take over? Yeah.
They have a very democratic structure by design, too. So.
So it's interesting to, you know, you don't know if they've spelled this out beforehand or if it's going to be left to the disciples to figure out afterwards.
A lot of elderly nuns that are part of their group, I notice, I think they actually, I bet they've worked it out, would be my guess, just from watching how they function.
Yeah, I would hope so. But it's good, I think, if that kind of structure is known to everybody beforehand, because after the teacher dies, if you introduce it then people don't have a chance to ask their questions and, you know, this kind of stuff.
So what is our structure?
Our structure is every, you know, I mean, we're running it, yeah? And so, like, in terms of, like, who takes over when I'm gone, that, you know, I've thought about. I can't pinpoint one person.
But it will be decided. It would be decided? Or would it be democratic? Or
well, I think that as time goes on and as you guys get older in ordination, then we'll discuss what's the best way to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you want to elect an abbot or an abbess after I go? You know? Or do you want me to appoint somebody? Or, you know, do you want to collectively... I think once I'm gone, then also I hope something will happen before I go, which is we will differentiate the teacher role and the administrator, chief administrator role. Right now, both of those are with me, and I think it would be very nice to gradually start to separate them. Yeah, so we can have a director who takes care of, you know, general running of the place, and a teacher who takes care of the spiritual growth of the people. Yeah. So I would like to see that happen in our structure as we get older.
Is there any places that do it that way?
Some places, Gunpo Abbey does it that way. Their problem is they have had lay people come in to be the director. That doesn't work. they made it a paid position and then hired lay people? No, that does not work. Okay, so don't do that.
We already set up, so that couldn't happen because it was set up that the monastics, the fully ordained, make the decisions.
Right.
That's how we're structured.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what happened also where John Sabern is.
Oh, right.
I mean, that's that center she worked there, helped to create it for 20 or 25 years, whatever, and then it was kind of taken over by lay people when the teacher died, and mm-hmm. she was kind of gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, she still works there, but I don't know if she lives there anymore.
I don't think she lives
there.
I don't know what's happened since we saw her, but when she was here, that's the way she explained it. I mean, she was associated, but she didn't live there, and she was kind of just working on her PhD or whatever she was doing.
Yeah. And that's because it was a center.
Right.
And so this is a monastery, so the monastics, you guys are in charge, and you make the decisions, and you keep it going.
So if something were to happen to you before we figure all this stuff out, then we just elect, the proper, or this one, she's the elders.
Or maybe you set up a council and you all really work together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? You could decide if you want one person to kind of take over, or if you want to work as a council and then maybe invite somebody else to come in and teach. Yeah.
Is this something that we can set aside time annually to discuss and to continue to clarify as we move forward?
Yeah. I'm just bringing this up now, not so that we reach decisions, but it's a thing that, you know, we'll be thinking about over time and making different decisions as we go along, too. Yeah, depending how long all of us live.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The structure we design may be influenced by that.
I think it's also good that you're going to this session on monastic curriculum development, and that we're going to start bringing that more deeply into the environment, because I think that will help us in shaping that organization, because we'll be talking about all those different things that impact the organization.
Well, curriculum development is more about your Vinaya training and your Dharma training. It's not so much about how to run a monastery. But it's interesting. In Taiwan, they actually teach you about the different departments and what's going on in the different departments, and they will have, on a certain level, people circulate so that you do different jobs in different departments. Of course, the things of major responsibility, you know, they're not going to give the books to somebody who, you know, doesn't do that well, and they're not going to give the media department to somebody who doesn't know about computers. But in terms of, like, the cooking and handling the altar and interacting with guests and many of those kinds of things, then people rotate through those different jobs so that you learn all of them and how they're done at the monastery. But I do like to ask, you know, when I'm with other monastics, how they organize their temples and how they do things. And this has been something in setting up this place, you know, that I talk to Catholics and all sorts of people that at our meetings, mm-hmm. in our monastic meetings, mm-hmm. to see how they've organized their places. Because I've had the experience of Dharma centers, and I know what I didn't want.
Mm-hmm. When you were in Germany, what was it like then? Was it Theravada? Remember you spoke
for
the Vietnamese?
Oh, at the Vietnamese?
Yeah, they had all these young
Westerners. A lot of the young Westerners there, and their teacher, he was both the teacher and the administrator there. And the young Westerners, but it was a monastery and also a Dharma center, but because there were so many monastics, that had a big impact on how it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they also had a clinic there, and he was the principal doctor in the clinic. Yeah. If you guys, you know, I came back and I said, I didn't hear anybody here complaining that we're too busy. I'm going to send you over there. Yeah. Or anybody here saying, oh, I want my own space. They lift four people to a bedroom that, you know, I told you about that. You know, when I came back, between, you walk in the room, it's long and narrow, so there's two bunk beds here, some kind of desk here, and just room for you to walk between the desk and the bunk beds. Yeah. And they managed it, and they were okay. You know, nobody complained to me about that. I was very surprised. I thought somebody would say, oh, we're so squished, and all of that. Okay, anyway, I've talked.